Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks on Mondays, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases you probably don't want to get. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I wanted to start with avian influenza because this is the infectious disease that keeps grabbing news headlines. So since the last time we spoke, there's been another confirmed human case, this time in Michigan. Like the first confirmed case, pretty mild symptoms. The number of dairy cattle herds with confirmed infections has increased to 56. Are we approaching the point where it's time to start worrying?
Well, I think we talked about that last time. When do we start worrying about this? And I think that the answer is we should start worrying a long time ago. We have started learning a long time ago. But when I say worrying, we need to put that in perspective. As you just pointed out, there have been two documented human cases in the United States. There probably have been more that have gone unrecognized. But this is not exploding. And that isn't to say it couldn't, but it is not at this point. So we should worry to the extent that it has the potential to cause tremendous harm, and we should act accordingly for that. So it's worrisome, but it is not at the point or near the point where we should be panicking about this.
Here is the thing that made my eyebrows go up last week. It was a letter to the editor, not a journal article, but a letter to the editor published by the New England Journal of Medicine, co-signed by a large number of researchers at Texas A&M, who apparently procured some milk from cows who were infected with avian influenza, attempted to inactivate the virus by heating the milk through a process that they consider analogous but not quite identical to industrial pasteurization, and found that they killed a lot of the virus but not all of it, and were still able to infect mice using the milk after it had been heated. The implication here being, if the virus mutated into a form in which it was readily transmitted to people, the nation's dairy supply could become a problem.
That's right. The New England Journal does a very good job in vetting the letters to the editor. As you pointed out, it's a letter to the editor. It's not vetted in the same way that journal articles are, but nevertheless, New England Journal does a good job with that. And so one needs to pay attention to what these authors documented. It is disturbing. Interestingly, the results that we have from pasteurization and then trying to identify infectious organisms prior to that and subsequent to that have not shown the ability to have live virus, that pasteurization works. So this study that was reported, as you point out, suggests that the possibility, or it actually, I think, is strong evidence for the possibility that live virus could transmit and infect mice and cause disease in mice, at least in some of the mice. The first statement, of course, is mice are not humans, but still, this is a red flag. It is not at the point where I think that we have to worry about our milk supply at this point, but it is something where we need. You and I keep saying this, Brian, we need a lot more science very quickly to answer these kind of concerns.
So my understanding is there already is a vaccine for H5N1 because the the concern about it jumping the species barrier has existed for many, many years. There's been some discussion in policy circles about vaccinating or even requiring vaccination of workers who are regularly in contact with dairy herds to reduce the likelihood of the virus jumping at the workplace. What do you make of the merits of that?
I think it is absolutely something that should be seriously considered, and it is being seriously considered. Protecting the workers would go a long way to helping to prevent this virus from escaping into the general public. Protecting herds would go a long way to preventing this virus from getting to outside of cows. So there's a lot of talk about this. It's important to point out that while we've known about H5N1 infecting other mammals since 1995, roughly, and we've seen human cases since then, the vaccine is not specific for this particular subvariant of H5N1. And we need to confirm that the vaccine that we currently have or the vaccine that we would produce would be effective. We don't have that kind of data at this point. There's every reason to think it should be. And there's every reason to use it if there's any kind of emergency, but we need to understand better how well this is going to work. It's somewhat analogous to the situation with COVID, where the original vaccine that was directed against the ancestral strain of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, does not work nearly as well against the more recent subvariants of Omicron. And that could be the same case with H5N1. So again, comes down to we need more science.
All right. At this point, we should open the phone lines for everyone who didn't get to call in a question during our fund drive. It's 1-800-958-9008. To put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg, that's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. While the phone lines fill up, we'll start with a couple of questions from the inbox. Madonna in Southern California wrote to thank you for the discussion last week about the proper use of Paxlovid, especially after rebound. She says she is 74 years old and immunosuppressed, and she's wondering what that means about if and when she should take Paxlovid if she gets infected and if she gets a rebound case.
Yes. I want to emphasize again that I was quoting one study about the best timing for taking Paxlovid. The bottom line for Madonna, and frankly, I think for everybody at this point, is take it as soon as you're diagnosed with COVID. That is, if you wake up in the morning and you're sick and you do a rapid test and it's positive, you get a prescription that day, start Paxlovid. We don't have enough data at this point to suggest that you should wait a day or two before you start it. So definitely for Madonna, who's older, which puts her at greater risk, and is immunocompromised, that puts her at greater risk for a bad outcome. So definitely, Madonna, hopefully you won't come down with COVID, but if you do, you start Paxlovid ASAP.
Madonna has a part two to her email. Apparently, she has increasing pain in her shoulder, and her rheumatologist has suggested it might be best to skip the vaccine dose that she is due for this month. She asks if you have any knowledge regarding shoulder injury related to vaccine administration and any thoughts on the advisability of waiting till the fall for her next shot.
Sure. This has been described from not just the COVID vaccine, but from vaccines in general. That is, some people will develop pain in their shoulder because the vaccine is given in the deltoid region, which is right around the shoulder. So this is a problem for some people. What Madonna and her doctor have to do is weigh the risks of further shoulder pain that she might get versus the risks of getting COVID. And if she was younger and was not immunocompromised, I think strategy of minimizing the number of injections she gets to is very appropriate. But she's not younger, and she is immunocompromised. And for me, the scales would tilt towards the risk of the shoulder pain versus the risks of getting COVID.
Meaning you would get the shot.
Yes, but I'm only speaking in generalities. There may be other issues that her doctor is considering that I'm certainly not aware of. But generally speaking, people at high risk, and she has two high risk factors, should avail themselves of the maximum amount of immunizations that they can get.
As an aside, something that doesn't get discussed much is that when people who are concerned about vaccines start waving their hands about the numbers of reported vaccine injuries, far and away the most common reported vaccine injury in the database that tracks these things is shoulder pain. Like, it's a mechanical injury from someone who's administering the shot, missing their target in the deltoid muscle and maybe nicking a tendon or something.
That's right. It's well described. And again, it doesn't have anything to do with this particular vaccine. It has to do with vaccines in general, getting them in the deltoid. One might ask the question, I'm asking myself right now, what about giving it in the buttocks? Large muscle should work. We don't have a lot of data in terms of efficacy of giving it in that region of the body. That is an alternative. But because with the lack of evidence and wanting to maximize protection against the virus, one is going to continue to have to give it in the deltoid.
All right. Let's go to the phone lines, which have been filling up at 1-800-958-9008. We'll start somewhere here in the East Bay with Amy. Good morning.
And I'm the one who called last week or sent in the email. Appreciate the discussion. My question today is, can you take Paxlovid and prednisone together? And number two, what is the age recommendation for starting Paxlovid? Thank you.
Sure. Amy, the answer to your first question is yes. That is, you can take Paxlovid and prednisone together. There's no contraindication between those two. And just as an aside, if you ever want to check drug interactions with Paxlovid, the Liverpool site is excellent, and the NIH site is excellent for taking a look at what drugs you're taking and whether they interact with Paxlovid and what that may mean for the dosage of the Paxlovid or the timing of that. So that's the answer to your first question. The second question you have to refresh my memory. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You've been so terrific. We really appreciate it and listen every week. The lower age limit for taking Paxlovid. So a friend called me. I'm a physician, and her son was having some increasing symptoms and was getting pushback from Kaiser because he's young and healthy. So can young folks take it? I know that they have passed.
The answer is yes. The vaccine is approved for all ages down to 6 months of age. So anybody can get it. I think most people...
No, I'm asking about Paxlovid, not the vaccine.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Paxlovid is approved to age 12. I believe it's age 12 and up can take it. It could be 18. I have to refresh my memory. I'd have to check on that. But it's approved for all ages. I think what the question is, Amy, is how necessary is it? And we don't have a convincing data that in an otherwise healthy younger person, less than 65, and or certainly less than 50, an otherwise healthy person needs to take Paxlovid because if they're vaccinated or previously have had COVID, they should handle another infection well. So that's a personal choice. It is approved for younger ages, but where it's really critical are in younger people who are at higher risk because of underlying conditions or people over 65.
But Dr. Schwartzberg, this is, we've discussed some of these studies in the past. there isn't like evidence that Paxlovid is ineffective for otherwise healthy young people. It just seems like the studies were underpowered. They didn't have enough people enrolled to show statistic significance, even though the younger people who got Paxlovid seemed to do better.
That's absolutely right. We just don't have the data to show that it makes a difference at this point, or convincingly makes a difference. Personally speaking, if I was younger than 65 and I came down with COVID, I would give serious consideration to it. Not because I would think that, oh gosh, if I don't take this, I'm going to get really terribly ill or wind up in the hospital. That's very unlikely at this point. But there is some evidence, and it's pretty good evidence, that taking Paxlovid does help prevent long COVID. So that's an argument that I think could be made for any age, although the data is not as sound as one would like. But there have been several studies that have shown that now.
Not to mention it might reduce the severity of your symptoms or the length of time you're sick, which is, you know, nothing to shake a stick at. Apologies for the audio quality on the phone lines, folks. We're going to let one more caller through before we try to change things, just so our chief engineer can listen to what's going on. Joel is on the line in San Francisco. Good morning, Joel.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can. What's your question?
Okay, I'm 76. I got the new COVID vaccine in September and January. And now Kaiser doesn't want to give me another vaccination until the new vaccine comes out in the fall. So does that leave me in more danger of getting COVID for the next 4 or 5 months?
Joel, it was a little hard to hear you. You said you're 76 and you got the COVID vaccine in September and then in January, and that...
Yes.
That's what he said. And now Kaiser doesn't want to give him another dose until the newly reformulated vaccine for the fall vaccination campaign is out.
The booster dose is recommended for people at higher risk, and because of your age, you are at higher risk. And the booster dose is recommended anywhere from 4 to 6 months after your initial dose. So your initial dose was September, and then you waited September, October, November, December, January. You were at 4.5 months, or between 4 and 5 months, when you got your second dose at that point. There are no recommendations for a third booster dose. And that's probably why Kaiser is saying that you have to wait until the fall for the reformulated new vaccine. Kaiser is correct about that. That is the standard recommendation. What you could do is go outside of Kaiser, although you'd have to pay for it, and get the vaccine at a pharmacy. It's been since January, so you're at 5 months now. You could certainly get another booster at this point, either this month or next, and then you'd still be a candidate for the fall vaccine. But that's why I think Kaiser is saying you've gotten your quota at this point.
All right. Dr. Swartz, we're going to take a couple more from the inbox till we've got the sound quality issues on our phone system straightened out. James has written in. James lives on Angel Island, where there is a lot of scrub and a lot of trees, and asks, in furtherance of pushing you outside the specific infectious disease that is the topic of this segment, if you could talk about Lyme disease and the best way to avoid and deal with it.
Sure. We're starting to see the nymphs now of the tick. So we're going into Lyme disease season. So the way to prevent yourself from getting Lyme disease is to prevent tick bites, because that's how you're going to catch this. The good news is where we live, that is in Northern California. There is Lyme disease here. but nothing to the extent that we see in states like Minnesota and that area of the country, and certainly nothing like we see in the hotbed of where Lyme disease is found in the Northeast, and then extending down the Eastern Corridor now. So less Lyme disease, you're less likely to get it if you get a tick bite here than other parts of the many other parts of the country, but you still should protect yourself against tick bites. So what that translates to is, in your situation, James, being in Angel Island area, where you are have contact with a lot of ticks, is to wear long sleeve shirts and pants that tuck into your socks so that the ticks would have trouble getting to you. You can have permethrin put into your clothing, which would repel ticks. The other thing you can do is to do a tick check every day you've been in a situation where you might have been exposed to ticks. And that would be looking through over your entire body. The reason that's very helpful is that it takes at least 24 hours, and most of the time up to about 48 and sometimes longer, for the tick that may be infected to transmit the bacterium that causes Lyme disease to you. So if you do a tick check every day after you've been exposed and remove the tick at that point, it has not had enough time to transmit to you. So those are the things you can do to really protect yourself against Lyme disease. What we desperately need is a vaccine. There was one 25 years or so ago that didn't make it through the that didn't survive marketplace issues and some litigation. But there's a lot of work now that's being done on the development of Lyme disease. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a vaccine within the very near future. And that would be really good for you given your living circumstances.
I'll jump in on a couple things. I've been hypervigilant about Lyme ever since I got it at the age of 8 years old. I grew up pretty close to the original hotspot for Lyme disease in the Northeast. The clothes tucking is something we all had drilled into us as kids, not just tucking your pants into your socks, but tucking your shirt into your pants, because the ticks tend to hop onto your body at a relatively low height and then crawl upwards till they find flesh. So you're just putting a much bigger obstacle course between them and you, and leaving a much smaller target in your body where you have to be really diligent about searching. And also, if you're in a place where you're thinking you're probably getting covered with ticks during the day, like if you're working outside, 10 minutes on high heat in the dryer will kill any ticks that you took home with you on your clothes. Dr. Swartzberg, one question I did have for you, which is advice my stepfather got recently from his doctor, because he spends a lot of time in a Lyme endemic area, is apparently you can take a single dose of doxycycline after being bitten by a tick as a prophylactic against developing an infection?
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, that's really good advice, Brian. See, I had the list of things to do. Doxycycline, or amoxicillin, taken, doxycycline has been most studied, taken after a tick bite will prevent you from getting Lyme disease. The risks of one dose of doxycycline are very, very small. The risk of one dose of amoxicillin would be very small. The flip side of that is to emphasize that this is in Lyme endemic areas, in parts of the country where we see a lot of Lyme disease. In the part of the country where we are, in most circumstances, while the risks of just taking one dose of a drug are very small, they're still likely to be greater than the risks of having an allergic reaction to that drug. And in Lyme non-endemic areas, it's something you should talk to your doctor about. But the necessity of that is markedly diminished.
Anyway, good question, James. This is definitely the time of year to worry about tick bites. They like it when the grass is still green and the ground is still a little bit moist and the air is cool. And boy, even if they don't have Lyme, they can hurt like hell. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending a Tuesday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.